This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Tuesday, domestic violence survivors could soon get 10 days paid leave. How will it help thousands in need? And McBoycott in response to the war in Ukraine. McDonald's pulls out of Russia after three decades.
McDonald's has now come out and said, right, that's it, we're selling up, we're pulling out. That is basically recognition of the reality here. Russia's war against Ukraine has changed things long term.
First up today, federal politics, and the Prime Minister has defended his proposed cuts to the public service as the battle over election costings gathers pace. Scott Morrison says it's a practical and responsible measure aimed at balancing his election promises, but unions say it will slash jobs after a decade of public service cuts. Our political reporter David Lipson joins me now. David, good afternoon. Just how much is the government proposing to cut from the public service?
Well, Sally, good afternoon. He's talking about ratcheting up the efficiency dividends imposed on the public service from 1.5% to 2%. Now, that may sound like a lot of mumbo-jumbo to a lot of people, and I think it's probably designed that way because you can call it an efficiency dividend, you can call it a talking umbrella if you want. The reality is it's a cut. And the only difference really here between, you know, a cut and an efficiency dividend is the government in some ways washes its hands of the decision by leaving it up to the senior bureaucrats to make the savings. Now, Scott Morrison says that those bureaucrats are well paid. It shouldn't be hard for them to find some money to cut on things like accommodation during travel or administration costs. But he insists there won't be any cuts to programs. Here he was.
If they can't find $2.7 billion out of a budget of $327.3 million, well, I've got a lot more confidence in them that they can achieve that. This is a sensible, practical measure, which is, I think, responsibly been applied.
This, of course, though, comes on the back of many years of efficiency dividends. And with inflation raging right now, it's going to hurt the public service even more. Melissa Donnelly certainly believes that. She's from the CPSU, the Public Service Union. She says it'll cost thousands of jobs.
We have seen years and years and years of budget cuts from the coalition. And what we estimate is that it will cost a further 5,500 jobs right across the public service. During COVID, we saw how under pressure our public services were with lines around the block outside Centrelink offices. In real terms, what it means is people in the community will wait longer to speak to someone at Centrelink. It means veterans' claims will wait longer and the backlog there will continue to grow. It's a real slap in the face for public sector workers who have worked so hard through fires, floods and the pandemic.
Melissa Donnelly there from the unions. Labor is proposing the opposite, really. They want to make the public service more efficient by cutting down on consultants who've been brought in to fill the gaps since these cuts started, and they want to feed the savings made back into the public service.
David, when will we see Labor's costings?
Well, it's looking like Thursday's the day. This, of course, is all about costings, these efficiency dividends. The government's cuts will actually mean that even with $2.3 billion in election spending, they'll be saving $1 billion in the budget. But remember, this just shaves $1 billion off the $224 billion in debt that's expected to be racked up over 4 years by the coalition. So Labor's costings, you know, I guess this is sort of aimed at putting the pressure on them. Labor's Jim Chalmers says, well, it's not about the quantity of what you're spending, but the quality. So he's clearly preparing the ground for a bigger spend on this election than the coalition.
The most important thing here is not whether deficits are a couple of billion dollars each year better or worse than what the government is proposing. What matters most is the quality of the investments. We'd be inheriting $1 trillion in debt and no plan to grow the economy the right way.
There was a time not so long ago when journalists got pretty excited about whose costings came out looking better now as the nation heads towards $1 trillion in debt. I guess we'll see whether we'll get so hot under the collar later this week.
Thank you, David. That's our political reporter, David Lipson. Well, debate is still raging about the coalition's policy, which would allow borrowers to access their superannuation to buy a home. But some economists remain convinced it would not only push prices higher, but force some people onto the age pension decades ahead. For more, I spoke a short time ago with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, good afternoon. There has been some criticism of the Coalition's proposal to allow people to dip into their super to get some help to buy a home. Has there been any support?
Well, good afternoon, Sally. I spoke to a handful of economists yesterday and also this morning. No economist thinks it's a good idea. All agree it would bump up house prices, but also a big concern that people eroding their superannuation early on, taking out that maximum $50,000, would diminish the all-important compounding interest and mean a lighter retirement nest egg. Some would need to rely on the aged pension, possibly decades ahead. And as we know, that's already under a lot of pressure. Also, economists at the real estate classified ads business Domain are the latest to say schemes like this only increase demand among a certain demographic and subsequently push up property prices at the more affordable end of the property market. But there's also another unintended consequence here. Forensic investigators say money launderers already wash a lot of dirty money in Australian real estate and have been able to pull it out often with good capital gain. Now, real estate agents, along with lawyers and accountants, are currently immune from anti-money laundering laws where transactions above $10,000 need to be declared. Anti-money laundering expert Andrew Jackson from First AML says anything that boosts real estate prices makes money laundering more tempting, and greater regulation via a national anti-corruption commission is needed to rein in the crooks.
I think there's a risk with depleting superannuation balances, an essential later life plan. If you reduce super, then we potentially add further burden for taxpayers down the line. But what it's going to do, I see, is accelerate the housing crisis. You're going to have first home buyers driving up the price because they can now put some further money in with their super. And that's going to have the same impact as money launderers putting their money in. It's going to drive prices up. It's going to reduce stock. And if the prices go up, it's not going to stop the money launderers throwing their cash into Australia. So what we have to do is we have to regulate. What we don't want is the real estate industry being taken advantage of by criminals, whether they are in or outside of Australia.
That's Andrew Jackson, their country manager at First AML. And Peter, while we have you, cryptocurrencies are in the wars at the moment, and now the ATO wants to get a slice of capital gains racked up before the crash. What's happening?
Well, that's right. Cryptocurrencies are in the midst of a crash, and that's probably got some way to go still. And the Australian Tax Office is on the case, warning investors who've either bought or sold crypto locally or via overseas trading exchanges that they need to determine if they have tax obligations here, whether that's a capital gain or a capital loss, and that needs to be declared in tax returns. Also, the ATO has now listed crypto as a top priority for this year and for taxpayers who failed to disclose their holdings, warning that crypto losses can't be offset against their salary or wages.
That's Peter Ryan there. Australian workers could soon be eligible for 10 days of paid leave to help escape from family and domestic violence. Advocates for the prevention of domestic violence say being able to stay in employment is vital for survivors who are trying to get their lives back on track. Rachel Mealy reports.
Those on the front line dealing with domestic and family violence see the significance of what they describe as a life-changing decision by the Fair Work Commission.
It would have been seen as completely off the radar, off the charts a decade ago that we would be providing this sort of leave. But we as a community are understanding more and more the impacts of domestic and family violence, the prevalence, you know, the fact that one in four women will experience some form of intimate partner violence.
Hayley Foster is the chief executive of the Sexual, Domestic and Family Violence Counselling and Advocacy Organisation Full Stop Australia. She says the Commission's decision, which allows anyone going through domestic and family violence to take paid leave, takes a giant step towards breaking down the stigmas of shame and embarrassment for people experiencing domestic violence.
What it's going to do is it's going to normalise it. It's going to make it really clear that this is an entitlement. It's something for everyone to be able to access, and then there's absolutely no room for discrimination, and that people's privacy in that situation must be respected as well.
Some employers like Telstra and big accounting firms already offer their staff 10 days of paid domestic violence leave. The Fair Work Commission's decision, if finalised, will apply to about 2.5 million Australians working under industrial awards. But if it's adopted by the federal government into the national employment standards, the leave would be available to more than 8 million workers. ACTU President Michelle O'Neill says she wants to see both sides of politics commit to doing this by this weekend's election.
We need to see the Morrison government commit to that today. We know that the Labor Party and Anthony Albanese have made that commitment. They've agreed that it should be 10 days paid leave in the National Employment Standards. We want to hear that matched by the Morrison government.
Employers groups will respond to the Commission's decision over the next few weeks. Leonora Rees is a senior lecturer in economics at RMIT University.
We kind of hear the same arguments over and over whenever there's a new policy introduced like this, such as several years ago when we were talking about the introduction of paid maternity leave, as it was known then, or parental leave, and the argument always comes to the surface, but won't this be potentially jeopardising women's employability? Won't it make it more costly to employ women? And we generally just haven't seen that. We've seen that on balance overall, the gains have been positive because it supports women's ongoing attachment to the workforce. It's a way of attracting and retaining the workers who you have invested in. And also, it's not just about dollars, it's also about morals and ethics here. It's a way of organisations and employers signalling that they're there to support their workers.
She says the decision could soon have implications across every Australian workplace.
So the Fair Work Commission's decision primarily and directly affects people who fall under modern awards, but this doesn't mean that people who aren't on one of these awards can't benefit indirectly from this decision, because what it can do is it sets the norm, it sets the standard or the default of what we expect from workers. And so it lifts the standards across the workforce more broadly.
That's Leonora Rees from RMIT, ending that report from Rachel Mealy. You're listening to The World Today. Well, while much of the media attention has subsided, the number of COVID deaths in Australia in 2022 is more than double the previous 2 years combined. Almost 8,000 Australians have died from the virus since the pandemic began. Nick Mora is a funeral director with more than 40 years' experience and is a member of the Australian Funeral Directors Association. He says COVID deaths are creating challenges for the industry.
They are, Sally. The numbers are still quite high. It's almost accepted now that it's a part of life, but we are still dealing with very high numbers of deaths related to COVID. I think at this particular point in time, with the election being the main frontline news in the media, it's really taken a back seat, but I feel that we still have to be very much aware and make the public very much aware that, you know, we're seeing that the deaths come through on a regular basis with COVID. The last thing we want to do is see these numbers rise.
Is it strange for you seeing that gap between the public attention on this issue and the reality of what you're seeing?
It is. It's really important to, you know, to stress the point that we have to deal with this. We will be dealing with this for however long. You know, we've gone from a daily report from the health minister stating what the case numbers are to now on page 9 of the paper, or not even mentioned in the media.
What sort of effect has the pandemic had on your industry? A lot of industries are having trouble getting staff. What's it like in the funeral industry at the moment?
Look, it's quite difficult for us, people being scared to come into the industry because they know they will have to be dealing with putting themselves into a closer contact with COVID. It's had a direct effect on cemeteries and crematoriums, trying to make a booking or a confirmation for a cemetery or crematorium because they have staff that are off with COVID, and that's had a direct effect on families having to wait a little bit longer for funeral arrangements to be completed.
So it's been difficult sometimes to be able to get a booking because of COVID staff disruption at crematorium and also at cemeteries.
Yes, yes. You combine the two, trying to find staff and then having the staff that are already employed off on COVID, it's putting a real stress on the cemetery and crematoria industry and funeral directors trying to conduct funerals.
sometimes has that meant that there's been a bit of a delay in being able to conduct the funeral?
Yes. Normally we'd have 4 to 5, 6 days on average for a funeral to be conducted from the time of death, now being blown out to somewhere and beyond 2 weeks for cemeteries to be able to accept a booking for a burial.
Have you ever seen it like that in the industry before, Nick?
No, not in my nearly 40 years of working in the industry. It's the first time that we've had any major issues like this where we've really had to keep deceased at our funeral homes for a week or so till we can actually have a burial or a cremation. In some cases where we have a church service and then we have to wait a longer period of time to bring the body back to our facility.
What's that like for families having these delays?
They're very understanding of the circumstances when we explain it to them, but I think it would be upsetting at the best of times, but having to wait for an extended period of time I think would be more difficult for them to go through that process of grieving.
What kind of industries do people come in from to join your industry?
Well, of recent times, we've had ex-police officers, ambulance officers, people in real estate. We find that people with good communication skills from a compassionate background tend to have an interest in the industry. But then when we sit down with them and explain, what has to be done, it's really the turning point for them making a decision on whether or not they're going to join us or look elsewhere.
That's Nick Mora from Mora Family Funerals in Sydney, a former president of the Australian Funeral Directors Association. Overseas now, in the United States, is once again reeling from deadly shootings motivated by racial hatred. It's been revealed that an anti-immigrant conspiracy called replacement theory is at the centre of one attack. The theory is linked to other white supremacist attacks and has been championed by far-right media commentators. Matt Bamford reports.
Outside a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, flowers and candles mark the scene of another mass shooting. Nearby, residents offer their thoughts and prayers to the 13 mostly black people who were shot here, 10 fatally. One of those was 86-year-old Ruth Whitfield. Her son, Garnell, tries to express his family's grief.
Obviously, there are no words that come to mind that fit this occasion. As we stand here as a family, forever changed, forever damaged, forever without the person who held us together throughout our entire life. Part of us is gone, senselessly taken from us by hate.
An 18-year-old man was arrested at the scene. The FBI is investigating the shooting as a hate crime and racially motivated violent extremism. Speaking alongside Garnell Whitfield, civil rights attorney Ben Crump has no doubt about the motive.
This was an act of domestic terrorism perpetrated by a young white supremacist.
In a manifesto published online, the suspect made a litany of racist arguments, labelling black people and immigrants as replacers, a nod to an anti-immigrant conspiracy rife among white supremacists. Replacement theory says Democratic politicians and other elites want to force demographic change through immigration. It's championed by right-wing media commentators like Fox's Tucker Carlson, who's used supremacist websites to source his content.
You cannot overstate the scale of demographic change underway right now in the United States. It's a direct assault on our democracy.
Mr. Carlson spent 400 episodes of his show hyping replacement theory, according to an investigation by the New York Times. Their views consistent with many white supremacist terrorists. Greg Barton is a professor of global Islamic politics at Deakin University.
It fed into the Christchurch terrorists' manifesto. He was directly echoing those ideas, not just from 4chan and 8chan forums where a lot of extremists congregate, but also, frankly, some of the commentary on free-to-air television and tabloid print media about issues of migration and fear of upending the order in which white Christians were sort of living.
Debate around migration has come at a critical time in the US as its ethnic demographics shift.
America is at a tipping point. There is a demographic reality that America used to be a majority, at least after European settlement, a majority white Anglo-Saxon population. They're no longer, or they're just going past the point of no longer being a mathematical majority.
Professor Barton says commentators like Tucker Carlson are turning a reasonable debate about migration into fear, and it's having deadly consequences.
I'm sure somebody like Tucker Carlson doesn't intend to advocate for violence of the sort we saw in Buffalo, and yet constantly people like that are injecting a sense of panic and a sense of having to stand up and sometimes literally take arms. But we also need to recognise that there is a continuum, there's a kind of a resonance, there's an echo chamber back and forth.
That's Professor Greg Barton from Deakin University, ending that report from Matt Bamford. Finally today, McDonald's is leaving Russia after more than 30 years. The company is selling its restaurants and will remove all use of its name and branding due to the war in Ukraine. Car brand Renault is also turning its back on Moscow. So what's the symbolic significance of two major companies pulling out of Russia? Carly Williams takes a look.
One of the first Western brands to cross what was then known as the Iron Curtain. McDonald's arrived in Moscow to a cheering crowd on January 30, 1990. The golden arches were largely welcome, but the Big Macs themselves, not always.
I expected more, I think.
I like this food. I know about this food.
It's all right. I'm glad to be here.
McDonald's in the Russian capital signified the end of the Cold War isolation. The company invested $50 million in Russia in 1990, and the cultural revolution of the Big Macs was, well, expensive.
Big Mac, French fries and a drink is the equivalent of half a day's wages.
3 decades after it arrived, McDonald's says it's begun the process of selling its business and de-arching restaurants in Russia. It's in response to the invasion of Ukraine. Russia editor of the BBC, Steve Rosenberg, was in Russia in 1990 and went to the original McDonald's on the opening day.
It was a huge moment. And when it opened, the very first Russian McDonald's, and I was in the queue, and it took me 3 hours to actually get inside. People were so excited to have their first taste of American burgers. And it felt as if, at that moment, that communist Russia was reaching out to capitalist America, that East and West were sort of joining hands, and this was going to be the start of something big, almost as if, you know, this fast, hot food was helping to end the Cold War. So it was a symbol. It really was a symbol of a better, safer future.
The world's most famous fast food restaurant and the taste of capitalism brought hope and promise. Dr. Leonid Petrov is a senior lecturer at the International College of Management in Sydney. He explains that when McDonald's started in 1990, Russia was still emerging from economic isolation and stagnation.
People would stockpile the hamburgers, like buying 30 hamburgers at the same time, stacking them into the freezer and then unfreezing them every day, and people would eat the whole month. At that time, there was shortage of food in the Soviet Union. Economy was collapsing. McDonald's provided with an alternative cuisine, something what was associated with the West, freedom, expectations, and globalism.
But fast forward 30 years and it's all gone wrong. Russia and the West have lost their appetite for each other, and it's not just McDonald's. French car brand Renault also announced it's handed over its Russian assets to the government in Moscow, with an option to buy it back within 6 years. President Vladimir Putin played down the idea that the war in Ukraine and sanctions have undone 30 years of progress.
The Soviet Union lived under sanctions and achieved colossal success.
McDonald's is bookending its chapter in Russia much how it started, during a monumental time in the country's history and carrying a symbolic message, although a very different one to that of the 90s.
But this strong signal which McDonald's and other multinational corporations send to Russia is that what is happening in Russian politics is incompatible with corporate social responsibility, humanism, democracy altogether.
Russia expert Steve Rosenberg believes McDonald's departure shows Moscow is drifting further and further from the West.
But I think the fact that McDonald's has now come out and said, right, that's it, we're selling up, we're pulling out of Russia, that is basically recognition of the reality here. And the reality is that things are not going to return to normal. that what most of the world calls Russia's war against Ukraine has changed things long term.
It's the BBC's Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, ending that report from Carly Williams. That's all from the World Today team for this Tuesday. The PM team will be along later today. We will be back same time tomorrow. I'm Sally Sara. Take care.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Interest rates, wages and house prices, they've overwhelmingly been the focus of the last 5 weeks of the election campaign. Today, the host of RN Breakfast, Patricia Karvelas, who's campaigned best on cost of living concerns. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.